Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy. Welcome to Love What You Play podcast. Today we'll be featuring an interview from our Youth Leadership Online event that we originally hosted in December of 2018. The full event is available online on our website for loveofthegame.ca. Our mission is to help organizations, coaches, sports leaders develop programs so kids love the game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning. We'd love to hear any feedback or comments down below, and please share this to others in your space so that we can all work together to bring the game back to the kids, because that's where it belongs. Hope you enjoy the chat and you get some great nuggets. Thank you.
Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy from Paradigm Sports. Thanks for joining us for our Winter Digital Summit through our digital platform for Love of the Game. We've got an amazing group of speakers like we did have in the summer, and I'm extremely humbled when they've accepted our invitation. Our next guest is Vicky Harbour, who is an Olympian that in rowing represented Canada in the 1980 and 1984 Summer Games. She's a professor emeritus at University of Alberta's Faculty of Kinesiology, Sport and Recreation. She is also a member of the Leadership Group for Sport for Life in Canada. And in 2012 was recognized by CAUS, and I'll read it out because it's a long acronym, the Canadian Association for the Advancement of Women in Sport and Physical Activity, as one of the top 20 women in sport and physical activity in Canada. I'm extremely humbled that you accept their invitation. Vicky, I'm really looking forward to our chat. Thanks for joining us.
It's a mutual pleasure, Glenn. I was thrilled when I got your email and really looking forward to our conversation today.
As am I. So I start with everybody in the summit, kind of going back in time. What sports were you involved with? Where did you grow up? Way back when, in terms of, you know, I guess first where you grow up and what sports and activities were you involved with, free play or organized growing up?
I was born and raised in Ottawa, nation's capital, and sport instantly became pivotal in my life. I have three older brothers, 6, 8, and 9 years my senior, and then along came me, so it was a keep up kind of place. Two of my brothers were very strong athletes. One played in the CFL. One was a very good pitcher, heading to major league, got to a farm team. So it was a very kind of sporty household. On top of that, though, the family was, I comedically call it a bit dysfunctional, and so again the family did not stay together, and let alone both parents really not valuing sport for me as a girl. And yet, because of the sort of the lack of family unit, sport in elementary school became actually my place of discipline, my place of being accepted, my place of being valued. And so there's many times, sport saved my bacon in many, many ways. What sports did I play? Gosh, anything I could get into. Everything from a lot of it in that time and era was school-based sports. Club sports really were non-existent.
Yeah.
And so all of those different, whether it was intramurals or some of the inter-school competitions, all kinds of individual sports of badminton, track and field. I love team sports, though. That's really where I really started to feel a passion for the team. And so volleyball became my first love at the high school level, and thanks to another high school coach from a different high school, that was my first taste of club sport. Played volleyball, got to play for our Canada, for the Ontario team, going to at that time the Canada Winter Games, and tried out for the junior national team. But wasn't quite good enough, sort of got onto the B list, but just loved it. Played basketball as well, played university basketball for the University of Ottawa, where I did my physical education degree. was bold enough and opportunistic enough. I got to the senior national basketball selection camp, and again, not good enough. I always called myself a self-professed red and white wannabe, and just needed to find a sport that loved me. And lo and behold, when I went then to Teachers College at the University of Western Ontario, now called Western, during Teachers College, got introduced to the sport of rowing. And that was my sport then. I was, even though I just started to row in April of 1979, was named to the 1980 Olympic team less than a year later in February. So it was, I think that's part of my relationship with Canadian Sport for Life, is that multi-sport background. I feel like I lived that. So there wasn't really very few sports I didn't get a chance to play.
The similarities. Now, I didn't get to your level. I never made it to the Olympics, but I was a sports junkie. I played everything. Like, if there was a sport that had a ball or a racket or whatever, obviously growing up in Montreal, started with hockey, but then baseball, rugby, football, where I actually won provincials in three different sports. So I'm the equivalent of a AAA athlete in the States, where I won provincials in hockey, football, and then in rugby. And obviously contact sports, so my knees kind of took a beating and concussions, what have you, but loved sport. And it wasn't just the organized, the unorganized, but we have similar pathway. I lost my father when I was 8 years old. And if it hadn't have been for those coaches and all these different sports, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation, because I, grade 8, grade 9, I was kind of going down this path with a lot of people that went the wrong path. But it was sport that kind of brought me back, and it was the coaches in those sports that said, hey, respect, punctuality, work ethic, you know, make the commitment. And it took me to a pretty high level. I did play quasi-junior football, collegiate rugby. But I mean, when you said not good enough to make it, I'm like, wait a minute, you got to that last camp. I'm like, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. And a similar anecdote with Duff Gibson, when I talked to him for the summit, he's the same thing. He tried everything. He said, you know, early on, he just wanted to go to the Olympics. That was his thing. He didn't know what sport he was going in. And I asked him, was tobogganing a big sport because he won in skeleton? He goes, no, I never really tobogganed as a kid, but I just kept playing. And finally, all of a sudden, I found my sport. I found the one I loved. He did it, wins the gold medal. Now he's been coaching and running a great program in Alberta. So great story. So what of all the stuff you played, what was your fondest memory? What did you love the most?
I have to say basketball. There was, as much as I loved rowing for taking me to a destination I aspired to, very satisfying. From an athlete perspective, basketball was incredibly rewarding. That package of being able to combine technical and tactical skills with the thoughtfulness, the creativity. I was lucky enough when I was between sports playing on a high level club where there were other members of this club team that had been with our Canadian women's national team, and Candy Clarkson was one of them. Probably, I mean, Ontario and so on might not remember her at all. And I was a point guard, and to be able to be teamed up with somebody like that was, oh my goodness, I could feed her from anywhere and she could just turn it into magic. And I think that's the real sense of teamwork with the physicality, the time and pressure requirements to make good decisions under pressure. Those ones I still have such fond memories of.
Yeah, and it's ironic, the sport that you end up excelling at the highest level, it was not necessarily the one that you really had that passion early on, but that's what led to keep going is love for sport and just being active, right? So that's what we're really trying to promote through our summit. So I know one of your kind of focus areas, and where I kind of heard through the grapevine when I was sitting on a call, is you recently went to Kamloops and said when we had our pre-call you were going to go back again, but Coaching girls versus boys, and having coached both, I do know there's differences. But many coaches that may be coaching one sport or the other, they may transfer over. They don't really recognize and they treat them both the same. I don't agree with that, and I've got some insight, but I'd love to hear what are some of the nuggets that you could share with coaches of what the differences are, girls versus boys.
Yeah, that probably by no accident. After doing teacher's college, ended up doing my graduate degree with master's and PhD at McMaster University. I would have to say it was a degree of convenience. It wasn't well thought out at all. I loved teaching, and based on being still an active participating athlete at the time, my graduate focus ended up on the female athlete. It was, sometimes they call research me-search, something that is fulfilling to me. I got to understand more about me and what happened. And so over time, from an academic point of view, was finding out all of those kinds of things that happen to a young girl or woman when she started training under hard, rigorous demands. And it dawned on me, some of my own experiences while still with our national rowing team, these coaches really don't understand much about us. And over time, I would say that that remains the case, is that our ability to translate good science into practical information, transfer it into the hands, heads, and hearts of coaches so they can make sense of it. Mm-hmm. I still think becomes one of our biggest challenges. And I was lucky enough to be able to work with a couple of our NSOs to create such a workshop for coaches. And that's where this workshop that you've just talked about really started to hit the ground.
Okay.
And it was very iterative. So I would try certain things and get very honest feedback saying, that doesn't make a bit of sense, or yeah, that's awesome, let's put this in. So over time, and so Kamloops, the workshop that you just mentioned, I delivered back in May of this year, and it's built around what I call an injury platform. And I think we can all understand injuries at face value. We know they're nasty. We know they take people out of their groove. Some are short-term, some are long-term. And so using that back of injuries, I created three different types of injuries. One was the traditional kinds of mechanical injuries, those that would affect the musculoskeletal pieces of the body. In particular for women, the big one is the non-impact anterior cruciate ligament injury.
ACL, yep.
Yep, the ACL injury, which affects young girls and women 3 to 8-fold, depending on the literature that you read, compared to boys and young men. Another one is around the shoulder injuries. We don't have as much quality deep data on that one. And then the third one is concussions, which is a fascinating, scary, turbulent kind of research area all at once. So those would be the mechanical ones. The second injury is what I call energetic. And it's based on energy balance, taking food intake, energy intake compared to what the energetic demands of training would be. And the reason I called it energetic is the heart and soul of my research program was around what's called the female athlete triad. And young girls and women who train, it was noted that they stopped menstruating. And even though that might be considered a time to celebrate, something to not be irritated or bothered by, The literature tells us that prolonged absence of the menstrual cycle leads to diminished bone mineral density, stress fractures, and so on. And the tip of that iceberg, it has to do with energy balance. And that's because things like the menstrual cycle and all the goodies that it comes with around the hormones and so on, they take energy. So as you can well imagine, talking to coaches about the menstrual cycle, that is an incredibly taboo topic. People get squeamish about it and thinking, we're not going to talk about that, are we? And saying, well, yeah, there's consequences to female athlete health. Hence, I came up with a name about an energetic injury to at least pave the way for a conversation.
Right.
The third injury, I initially called it injuries of the heart, heart being in quotation marks. And it has since been more commonly called psychosocial. And those are where the young girl or woman feels not accepted, not welcomed into her environment for one reason or the other. It can be the power of cliques. It can be the power of not being technically skilled enough, not being cool enough, any number of reasons how and why she gets excluded. And so those, that became the scaffolding for the workshop, is that, look, we've got identified in the literature these three kinds of injuries: mechanical, energetic, psychosocial. Let's go down the healthy pathway of finding out what's behind these injuries, and then how can we reduce the occurrence of these. And so the second half of the workshop then comes into implementation themes. And they're built then on the back of, well, if this psychosocial theme is really a heavy underpinning of why girls either leave sport, and I think nowadays, Glenn, to be honest, I think a lot of girls don't even dip their toe in the water of sport. It is so...
Yeah, they're barely, you're right. I totally agree.
Yeah. So I present that one first. So what do we do in our coaching programs, in our clubs, in our schools to create a welcoming environment? And the second piece becomes, how well do we progress skill acquisition? And skill acquisition from a holistic athlete development point of view. So not just the technical tactical pieces, but how do we physically progress the athlete? How do we psychologically progress them? How do we progress them cognitively, socially, and emotionally? And that's a fascinating area. And then the third one is the implementation is role models. And I put a heavy emphasis on not of the red and white variety. So many times we go to YouTube, and it's not to dismiss the efforts and achievements of those of our athletes that do get to wear red and white. It's just that they are so lacking in tangibility for our young girls. And so the context of role models becomes, who's right within our reach? So clubs, for example, that often clubs are working across different age groups, having the 12-year-old group work with the 8-year-olds is an example of using role models.
Yep.
So it's built on that three injuries with three implementation themes. And that's the workshop that I deliver and refine it just about every time I go in and do it, because I want to keep it up to date.
Yeah, I mean, because I've done so many talks and workshops, every time I do it, I'm going, okay, I got to do this a little bit better. What's resonating? I always ask, you know, what resonated with you? What didn't resonate? What flew over your head like the Concorde? That's one of my questions. And coaches, you can tell, because you look at the room, and it doesn't matter how big the room is, and when you start seeing deer in headlights, and that usually is after lunch on a Sunday afternoon on a 2-day clinic, okay, what can I do to and make this more exciting? So what I've started to do, have you seen the Iceland football's Viking clap that they did when they went to Euro? So everybody goes up. So I get them after Sunday afternoon, okay, everybody stand up, YMCA. And I just did it yesterday. And coach is like, where is this guy going? What's he doing? Like a little whack job. Okay, now listen to me. When I go, boom, you go, oh. And they're like, what? And it's going to speed up. And well, I'm not going to make you do that a minute and a half they did with 300,000 people in Iceland after they came back. We'll do like the 40-second version with boom, 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 boom. And then that's the kind of the energizer thing to do to keep them awake. Because a lot of times these can be a little bit dry. The material can be a little bit too much. But it's exciting that you're going at it from a different spin instead of do this, do this, do this, but giving them the reasons why. ACL surgery, that's a big one. Like statistic that I came across that I've shared out, it's been a 400% increase between 9 and 12 years old, mm-hmm. which blew my mind. I mean, I've had multiple surgeries because of playing all these sports, but I didn't have them until my late teens. Yeah. And having a full reconstruction in like my 20s, but girls 9 to 12 years old, is that the statistic that's still being kicked around, like a huge percentage?
And you might be more up to date on the actual surgical interventions.
Yeah.
They say that about the surgery, that those though that do get surgery, very like about 40% will come back to play at their previous level. Mm. About 80% will come back to play, but not at that level that they had before. And the surgery numbers, I wasn't aware of it going that much lower than the age of 12. There's some concerns about a surgical intervention in a young growing body, because as they grow, right. the surgical repair stands a chance of not being successful over time. Right.
Yeah.
And then the risks for osteoarthritis, the risks for re-injury, whether it's in the same or the other knee, it's devastating for so many reasons.
Yeah, and a lot of what I'm hearing, what's leading to it is the coaches don't know enough about the biomechanics. They don't know enough about the a lot of the girls in soccer in particular. That's a sport that kind of has the worst cause, partly because I call it the Anson Doran syndrome. I don't know if you're familiar with Anson Doran, head coach of North Carolina, 22 national. But he hates it. He's having to recruit girls earlier and earlier and earlier. And most recently, that one I found at 12 years old, he's offering a girl a full ride scholarship. And so that's what's pushing these parents to get their girls to specialize in soccer at like 9, 10, 11 years old. So 10, 11, they're starting to have ACL problems. And I'm like, okay, what's causing this? What's the cause? Mm-hmm. Yes, the specialization, but part is the coaches don't have the skill to identify dominant versus non-dominant side. And that planting leg in soccer is where they're suffering a lot of the ACL tears, because they're planting and they're always planting one side instead of right, left, right, left. Mm-hmm. So at least if they avoided just the dominant side, that would help them. Is that something that you've come across?
Yeah, I would say the root of it is, well, if we back up just a wee bit, understanding that the cause of these injuries, there's some intrinsic reasons and factors due to simply the biology of being female. Pieces that we really can't change, the hormonal output and so on. Some of the musculoskeletal architecture is different. However, there are extrinsic factors which can be modified. And in particular, one that the Norwegians have been world leaders in this, a couple of groups out of the U.S., California and Cincinnati have really dug in and understood what can we do to modify or understanding the risk of these injuries. And a lot of it has to do under this neuromuscular training.
Gotcha.
And so I would say that the greatest villain to youth injuries is overuse repetitive type movements. And even a well-meaning soccer coach ensuring there's, you know, opportunities for bilateral, this, that, and the other thing, it still remains a largely repetitive overuse experience.
Yeah.
You know, the child isn't getting into a slip and slide, ice and snow environment. They're not getting into water, the whole acrobatic component. And I understand the drivers of it, and you explained it very well around this drive, particularly in the United States, about scholarships and the recruitment treadmill that occurs around that. So I would say that devotion to a single sport at the expense of a well-rounded athletic development is a primary cause. Then when we think about girls and how they now differ from boys, is that when girls and boys go through their growth spurt, so girls will hit their growth spurt a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. So imagine you're looking through a class of grade 6, grade 7 girls and boys, And it's not unusual to see the girls a head taller. You know, they start their growth spurt on average earlier. And Greg Myers out of the U.S., he's one of the best researchers in this non-impact ACL injury. And he described it that when boys and girls go through this growth spurt and the other associated things that go on through puberty, is that girls will grow in height, but their muscle mass will not grow at the same rate. And nor will they grow to the same level compared to a boy. It's as if they are a car. And so the car gets bigger, but the engine or the muscle mass stays small. Boys, on the other hand, they're a little bit more tightly correlated, that as they grow, as their car gets bigger, their engine, their muscle mass grows with it. As a result of that separation in the car and the engine, is that girls, when they're going through their growth spurt, they're almost at greater risk, because as they grow, their ability to be more coordinated and the biomechanics and the demands of landing forces and so on become more challenging. Greg Myers in the U.S. has actually been trying to make this non-impact ACL program mandatory within physical education classes because of what they know from the literature. So it's long-winded reply around, but first and foremost, early single sport specialization is the major villain.
Yeah.
And then I think the second one comes under the premise as, do we really understand growth and development of our youth? Because our programs typically don't serve in a positive kind of way to support that growth and development.
Yeah, and it's kind of what's driving, and I'm still trying to wrap my brain on the actual concept, but biobanding has been kind of been thrown around in the UK, and I've got a colleague there and tried to explain it to me, and I kind of, okay, and keeping it chronological age so that their development age is relative to, so they're all based the same size. It's kind of how he explained it to me. Because when I coach hockey, and because in Western Canada, our numbers are nowhere near what they are in the East. So we don't have like a minor midget, you know, one age group. We have 2 years. So in Adam, there's 2 years and so on as you go up the pipeline. But even in Adam, I had like a really late birth year, because it's calendar year, like end of December kid, first year. And he was like 80 pounds. And then I had a second year kid that was 160. Like it was extreme, and he's a foot and a half taller. Like, and I've showed this picture, this chronological age, and girls, I'll never forget, when I was in elementary school, we had a girl in our class who ended up becoming a model. She's a foot and a half taller than all of us. Like, all the guys were looking up at her. Like, oh, Tracy, how are you doing? Like, she was 6 foot, like one. She had really huge growth spurt really early. So how do we combat that? Like, what can organizations do to get the coaches to understand that whole growth and development matrix, because it goes hand in hand with girls but also with boys?
Absolutely. And so I as with many things, it's not going to be a one single solution, and I think there would have to be some pretty genuine willingness to examine the way we currently prepare coaches, if we just focus on coaches. Although, to be quite honest, I could also include teachers and again, not just the physical education teachers, but elementary school teachers, around what are the requirements for appropriate physical activity experiences for our growing youth. And neither educators or coaches are often provided that, unless that coach or educator has a huge desire in and of themselves to go and get extra training and education. Mentioning the biobanding is not so much based on chronological age as it's the percent of their predicted adult height, which that predicted adult height is derived from the height of mom and dad. And so it allows for still variability within absolute stature. You can have, imagine the height of your own parents. Mm-hmm. If you can think of somebody else who might have had taller parents or shorter parents. So there's still going to be variability. But it, what it does is it matches those kids based on their developmental maturation. So that you could have players that are in the 80th percentile of their predicted adult height playing or training together. And that might be a different pitch or a different court or a different arena from where the 90th percentile.
Gotcha. Good.
And it's not an either or. So Sean Cumming, who's kind of the world guru behind this from Bath University, I had the great fortune, and what I do now is if I've got a question, I end up just phoning or emailing these people and saying,
help.
I'm clearly in what you're up to. And so I ended up having several fabulous emails with him, a couple of Skype calls. We ended up from Sport for Life doing a webinar on it because our Canadian Soccer Association is very keen on this. U.S. Soccer is also going through some biobanding tournaments. And it's ending up, some people are worried that it's and this either or. So we're not abandoning chronological age, not at all. But it becomes an appropriate adjunct. So for those kids that are late matures, so everybody else is taken off in physicality and so on, by putting the late mature into a more developmentally appropriate group, they get to feel their own contributions come out, whether it's in leadership, whether it's in technical or tactical skills. There's also no advantage for the early mature, because most early matures, and the literature tells us this now, is the kid that just skyrockets often relies on their physicality alone to become the superstar amongst all of those age-matched but smaller kids.
Yeah.
And what's been determined now is that this young athlete, because they've relied on physicality to be successful, their technical skills, their tactical skills are less than their peers around them because they've never had to challenge them. They've never had to develop them. So through biobanding, this early mature now gets in the mix with kids of perhaps a little bit older chronological age, but same kind of predicted adult height. And now this athlete who's taller compared to their age matched peers now has to start working on their technical skills to stay afloat. So there's merits to this, and Sean makes it very clear, this is not an either or situation. It's meant to be an adjunct to training and occasional competition to help keep more athletes in the pool. I don't mean the swimming pool. I mean, just in that overall pool of selection.
In the pipeline.
Exactly. Yeah. Cause that's another huge flaw within our system is that we cull kids from sport way too early for no good reason at all.
Yeah, and I remember when I was at the, I guess it was the beginning of this year, at the summit in Gatineau, and the last day there was talk about India and how a lot of those kids, 10, 11 years old, if you're not going down the pipeline, like the high performance, you're done. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. What about the kids that want to go down the recreation stream? Or what if they are a late bloomer and they haven't quite blossomed or their growth and development? What about those kids? And they just get kicked to the curb? I don't agree with that. Mm-hmm. You have to be able to identify it. But when you get too scientific, and having firsthand experience, I don't know how many thousands of coaches I've interacted with, I have to basically take a lot of the stuff that's handed to me. Fortunately, I have a degree. I'm not a doctor or what have you, but I can kind of dummy it down in layman's terms because they're parent coaches. They may be mechanics. They may have never done any of this stuff before and say, okay, you know, think of it in this perspective, like the car analogy you were given earlier, which is great. So how do we get either biobanding or something like it that'll help offset that whole epidemic that is happening down to the masses? So I'll give you a perfect example, and that is LTAD, LTPD, physical literacy, fundamental motor skills. They're all acronyms that you've been living in. Everyone's sport for life, act for life. Most coaches that are stepping up are parents, and unless they're pointed in the direction of these sites, they've not heard of the concepts. And I know the NSOs are all trying to get it to them, but how do we, you know, it kind of goes hand in hand. We get to those people when they start instead of 5 years down the pipeline.
Mm-hmm. So I love that question because I chew on that question a lot around what are the ways in which we can do this kind of work, creating more positive developmental environments. And because of the nature of coaches, and as you say, we lean heavily on the volunteer mom and pop show to make our sport system run. And I don't know if you know the name Richard Bailey out of the UK. And
yeah, I actually follow him on Twitter.
Yeah.
He's got some great stuff. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And I heard a podcast of his some time ago, and he talked about that very issue, is that we are so tentative in what we ask of our volunteer coaches. We're so sensitive to them being super busy and this, that, and the other thing. And then he gave the analogy of firefighters.
Yeah. A lot of fire every year.
Yeah. Fire stations are run largely by volunteers. And do you think their training is voluntary? Mm-hmm. You know, just pick up a few skills as we go. No. And so there's something about the value that is missing. To sound quite blunt, we really aren't that caring about the experiences of our children when they're in a sport environment. And people can refute that all they want, but the actions of our sport ecosystem, actions speak louder than words. So what could we do? Well, if the kind of coming back a little bit to what we spoke about earlier around, do we really understand growth and development of our children? And the literature around what's going on in a child's body, and particularly in their brain, has exploded in the last decade. We understand so much more around a young child's development of executive functions, their social emotional learning skills. And on top of that, the powerful impact of physical activity and sport on that developing body and brain.
Yep.
So that to me speaks to a natural intersection of a child's life. Who are all of those important people in those important institutions of a child's life? So some type of collaboration and a coherency of how we are working to support the development of our youth. So it's going to require early childhood education. It's going to require the traditional education pathway. It's going to require sport and recreation. And at a community level, I think that stands the best chance for, as I say, a coherent approach to creating positive developmental environments for our children. Again, to really irritate people, I think our competition schedule, our competition structures, feeds that early specialization monster. So that too needs to be examined, revised, modified. This whole thing within ice hockey around Hockey Canada mandating the cross ice game.
And the pushback that happened in Ontario. And yeah. had it actually been rolled out, a perfect example is BC Hockey pulled the trigger. They went, we're doing it. And they went novice initiation, so 5 to 8 years old, all in one swoop. Hockey Canada, because they knew they were going to get pushback, we'll do it in phases. We'll do the initiation 5-6, we'll wait a couple of years, and we'll do, well, the 5-6, I'll never forget last year when they were rolling it out, and there was this alliance or group or whatever, the elite six-year-olds are playing with their seven-year-olds, full ice hockey, they push back, and they had to grandfather them for a year, even though it is in the best interest of the kid. It's a football field. Like, I coached when I watched that, and I was like, this is crazy. But it would also have prevented stuff like happened that went in a lot of newspapers, and I got wind of it, the Vancouver Sun. Did you hear about the 41-0 novice game? Like, are you kidding me? That wasn't mercy that they let it go. And then the coach, it was trying to teach resiliency of his team, like on both fronts, the coach that let that happen. Mm-hmm. I was appalled. Everyone I've shared that with, mm-hmm. they're just like, what? That's for the over competition at the early age groups. Me personally, and a lot of people think I'm nuts. I think we should kind of look at the Norway model. They're not competing until 13 in most areas. Sweden, same thing, non-competitive until 13. And hockey could do it. We could push it to Bantam where they introduce body checking. Okay, well, up until then, play for the love and the passion of the game. But who's driving the competition? Is it the kids? It's the parents.
Yeah. That's such a good point, and you're right. Why does it take a 41-0 game to pique people's interest or attention to that matter, for sure? And Sport for Life put out a short document some years ago called Competition is a Good Servant but a Poor Master, because coaches coach to the competition. Parents make choices on behalf of their children based on competition outcomes. So competition becomes this sun-like feature where everybody orbits around it. The gravitational pull of competition is irrefutable. And yet the resistance and the lack of inclination to even examine competition and how that might support growth and development of an athlete is so challenging. I know part of it is saying, well, we host this tournament and it's a major revenue stream for us, so we can't possibly cancel it or modify it or reduce it. And so there is, just the number of system impediments. I think there are some parents and coaches who do want to do a better job but feel quite hopeless and helpless because the system and the peer pressure goes way beyond the athlete. In fact, that thing called FOMO, fear of missing out, everybody thought it was just an adolescent thing. Yeah. But they're right in there.
Oh, yeah, no, it's keeping up with the Joneses type.
Exactly.
And the horror stories I'm hearing about the money, like what it's costing these families. When I grew up, I paid $125 for football, and that included my equipment. And I used the same pair of cleats I used for rugby and baseball. Like, what happened to those days? Like, now it's, if you're playing a sport, it's $5,000. It's like the average, $10,000 you go into an academy, then a club, and you keep, where's that money coming from? Lines of credit cards, mortgages, it's scary.
Yeah.
So, it kind of comes, and just want to touch on this one. You played basketball, and it seemed like that was a passion sport. So what were the top three characteristics of your basketball coach or your greatest coach that you ever had?
Oh, wow. Well, I would certainly say that the clarity around expectations of what was I being asked to do? And there was such clarity around that, that it was so easily understood around whether it was what time you showed up, intensity of effort, the work ethic. There was, again, clarity of expectation. I would say what fell hand in hand within that as well is that discipline. And I don't mean the ugly kind of discipline, but more
the demanding, not the demeaning, like wanting you to be the best you could be, that kind of thing.
Yes, and uniformly applied discipline. I found that, when I think back to that, where I'm really reflecting on those very positive experiences I had in high school. I came from an era where high school was grade 9 to 13, which just sounds absurd nowadays. But to spend 5 years with those teachers who were not only my physical education and health teachers, but were also the same people that coached me. The sense of community, the sense of accountability, that I was a part of this community and I had my bit to do. So that, the clarity around expectations, that discipline feature. And I have to say as well, with a heavy dose of sense of humor. And I don't mean the always the slap and tickle variety, but the idea of understanding the ups and downs. And perhaps I go back to high school now that I think about it, and that sense of community is that the ups and downs, the discipline and expectations were pervasive across the sport side of school, the academic side of school. We had an unbelievable intramural program. In other parts, our school was renowned for its clubs and its band. And there was this, I think the culture of the school I went to was very much built on the back of, you know, get involved in something, and it will pay great dividends. So those are sort of the stellar features or attributes of coaches.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And there's so many top three. I get all these answers, but for me, the demanding coaches, the ones that wanted me to get better and help me get better and push me and like push you, but not where they're pushing now. They've crossed the line where they're screaming at the top of the lungs. A lot of it's negative. And, you know, hang on a second. That's what's pushing up that white flag. A lot of these kids, they don't want to deal with that, but demanding is okay, because everybody wants to become better as a person or better at a sport or whatever the case may be. It's when they cross that line, that's where I've seen the fine line over the years. We had a lot of coaches that pushed us pretty hard when we grew up, but I turned out okay. and it's how you do it, and it's not the what have you. So what can coaches then do to so kids love the respect of sport that they're doing more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning?
Yeah, I think coaches need some huge support from their clubs. I think expecting a coach to go out and do the workshops, you know, do the extra learning, or even the bare minimal learning, if they don't come back to their clubs and almost have their TD or their athletic director or someone, you know, club president, almost bouncing up and down at the door, waiting for them to come in saying, tell me what you learned. What are the riches you brought back to us? How can I help you spread this great stuff? How can I, you know, what resources or supports can I give you? And so I don't know Peter Drucker is this business management guy, and it's a phrase I learned a while ago. And his quote is, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And the idea is that if the strategy that you bring back, let's say to create positive experiences for youth in sport, but the overall culture is much more focused on winning in the moment or bringing in greater revenue or putting more splash on next year's uniform and kit, then the value towards what happens to those athletes when they step across the threshold of your sport club clearly doesn't matter that much. So what can we do? Not to be a real Debbie Downer, but I think sport's in a really dark place right now.
Couldn't agree with you more. We're at a crossroads. We can either go one way or we can go the other way. And obviously I'm fighting for the right fork, and the left fork is pushing back. So I talk with my wife all the time. She goes, you know, you took that leap of faith, you jumped off, you're trying to help these kids. I get it. But it's really silly. It comes down to the money. And how are you going to win that war against all these private companies now that are exploding everywhere? There's specialization. I'm going to keep pushing back. Like I'm going to just keep educating. There'll be a point. I was talking to Wade Gilbert in the summer. He kind of said, you know, I don't think we're going to completely negate specialization, because there's going to be those parents that want their kids to go down that path. But we have to find a happy medium where kids don't burn out, they don't quit, they don't get the overuse injuries, and it's not all about the money. That it's about growth, development, we find the bioband, like all the science stuff that's there. Yeah. Until we get that in play, I think we're still going to have this that path on the left that's going to just keep growing, because it's just exploded the last 10 years.
Yeah, and no doubt about it. I mean, we've become a very outcome-oriented society. Absolutely. And for even people who aren't well informed about sport, they can understand an outcome of a win and a loss. And so I think that's where many parents, and because many parents are the coaches, that they're driven towards that kind of outcome. So what can we do to broaden the view, or, you know, take the blinders off that we have other outcomes to look at? And in particular with our 16 and unders, we now have some much better measures, which are stronger indicators of positive youth development, positive development through sport. And yet, could we infiltrate coach education to say, you know what you could be looking for in your team selection? Not just how fast they skate or how quickly they can handle pucks through the cones, but set up a scenario where they have to work with two or three others that they don't know and give them a problem to solve. See how they manage. So this idea of exploring social cohesion, responsible social awareness, do they demonstrate any type of empathy or understanding towards others? How do they make decisions under reduced time and increased pressure? So there are some wonderful scenarios which are being developed, again, through education, which can easily be brought into the sport context, which is what our children need right now, as opposed to, I want you to come in and do it, and the only option is to do it better than everybody else. And given that mandate for our youngsters, we are cultivating that lack of social cohesion, and where we wonder why our, you know, kids can't operate in teams very well. And often it's because of the way they've been nurtured along the way, that, you know, that's what they're being told to do. So I think, yes, alternative types of coach content, making it palatable, manageable, chewable, the way you describe you do it. But in absence of being supported by their club, I don't know.
No, I couldn't agree with you more, because, you know, I knocked on a whole bunch of doors many, many years and said, hey, what are you doing in terms of coach development? And, you know, while we're doing the NCCP program, I said, what are you doing on top of that? You know, and I get that, I said, is there any budget for coach development? But you have a big budget for player development. And we're hiring these professional coaches and they're working with their players. Well, okay, so couldn't you do that more cost effectively? You develop your coaches to develop your players? And they haven't quite seen that model. And some of the organizations I've been talking to, the technical directors are making hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I'm like, wait a minute here. I'm I in the wrong profession? Like, what did I do wrong? And we do have to get that model so that the coaches can get the information better, because they're looking for it, but they're just not getting it, and they don't know where to look for it. So it's kind of like chicken after egg.
And one point on that, Glenn, that I would add is that along with early single sport specialization has been a sport by sport club mindset. And a lot of the ideas and positive programming for quality sport experiences are not sport specific. So when we think about what can we do to inform coaches about better and different ways, it at some level, dealing with at least 14-year-olds and under, there is so much we could do collectively. So it doesn't matter whether it's ice hockey, soccer, basketball, we could join forces and share in the community learning without it costing any, you know, with the burden of cost lying just on one sport. And yet that too, there's fear when I've tried to do that with my coaching female athlete workshop, saying, hey, you know, sport X is asking me in, and if you like, don't hesitate to ask sport Y and Z in as well. and they get a bit nervous because they think it might lead to loss of membership, and loss of membership equals loss of revenue. And then, so, yeah. But I still think doing more together across the community, whether it's across the different sectors combined with across the sports, is really one way that we could start to address some of the larger social problems we have with sport.
I agree. It's a similar kind of concept you do in Kamloops. I was invited. It started with Nanaimo Minor Hockey, mm-hmm. and it's kind of grown. You know, when we finally worked out the dust and figured, okay, you're coming over here, and we'll bring you over. You do a couple of talks. Well, they invited Vancouver Island University. A few of their students and professors came from that.
Thanks for joining us this week. You can find us on Facebook for Love of the Game, Twitter for lovethegame.ca. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode.